Everything y'all do. Please be seated. We'll hear from Petitioner in 6257.
And we look forward to the later will be represented by Carl Adams.
May it please the court, my name is Carl David Adams with the Dallas law firm of Adams & Francis, and we're here on behalf of the relators in this matter. This is a pretrial mandamus action in a medical malpractice case filed by the estate and the family of Samuel Leroy Thomas. Samuel Leroy Thomas was a 48-year-old black man who died from brain damage caused by a lack of oxygen or hypoxia while he was under general anesthesia for day surgery at the Methodist Hospital in Dallas. He was there for a scope test of his bladder, which lasted less than 10 minutes, required no incisions or stitches, and was uneventful. In the instance that when the surgery was over with, he left the surgery room in stable condition. He was then transported by the staff of Methodist Hospitals of Dallas to the recovery room, where he was to have been monitored by the staff while he came out from underneath the effects of the anesthesia drugs given him. After he had been in the recovery room for something approaching 50 minutes, he was observed to be having seizures, and the experts in the case have testified that the type and character of seizures that he had are classical signs of hypoxic coma or brain damage caused by lack of oxygen. After this was discovered, he was in this hypoxic coma for 19 days and died as a result of the insult. Soon after his condition became known, and prior to the time the family was able to secure an independent autopsy with the Dallas County Medical Examiner's Office, the anesthesia record of this patient's treatment from the time he went into the surgery until the time his seizures started in recovery room suddenly became missing. And it's remained missing since May of 1985, and it's missing here today.
Would you elaborate on what you mean by suddenly became missing?
It was in the chart, seen by a number of the doctors as the patient went along for a number of days, and then all of a sudden one day was not there. Experts, even for the plaintiff that were called in to figure out by the family, remember that it was in the chart and saw it. And then some, I think 2 weeks after the event, but prior to his death, some 5 or 6 days prior to his death, the chart became missing. The hospital in this case, in sworn depositions, has sworn that no one at the hospital knows anything whatsoever about how or exactly at whose hands this anesthesia record became missing. In the trial court below, the family pled two items that are the subject of our hearing here today.
Was the anesthesia record the only thing missing from the hospital records?
Yes, sir, to our knowledge. There may have been one lab report or some incidental matter that's not been located, but for the most part, the anesthesia record is the only one that we're able to see is missing. In the trial court, the family pled that while certain acts of negligence are establishable, that they were entitled to rely upon the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, because we claim that both laymen and medical experts can establish that it is a medical fact that a patient cannot come out of a modern hospital recovery room setting with hypoxic brain damage caused by the lack of oxygen if there has been no negligence or deviation from the standard of care with regard to monitoring that patient. Likewise, the plaintiffs in the trial court below pled that the loss vital portions of the medical chart created a presumption of fraud against the hospital, and that unless and until the hospital could overcome that presumption by showing that its loss of the records was not intentional, that it shouldn't be allowed to offer any secondary evidence in the case, and that or it shouldn't be allowed to defend the case at all. The trial court granted exceptions, which the defendant hospital filed, to both of these matters. The defendant claimed that because the family was unable to produce any evidence of what happened to the record, that therefore the trial court could not assume that it was an intentional spoliation, and as such, the missing record had no legal effect in the case whatsoever. The trial court agreed, pitched out that form of pleading by the family. The hospital also claimed that the family's pleadings of res ipsa were inappropriate, should be stricken, because, number one, they claimed that as a matter of law, this event, the condition of this patient, hypoxic brain damage, is too complex a medical event for the average layman to comprehend it as the type that does not occur without negligence. And secondly, that in addition to that this family should not be allowed to establish that medical fact by the use of experts against a medical tortfeasor such as Methodist Hospitals of Dallas. I will discuss the res ipsa points first and the spoliation points second. Now, res ipsa loquitur is a common law rule of both circumstantial evidence and of law that says that the thing speaks for itself. It basically means that a plaintiff cannot be denied a jury determination on the defendant's negligence where that plaintiff establishes that the occurrence is one that does not occur without negligence and that the defendant was in control of the thing that brought about the injury. It's a form of circumstantial establishment of negligence on the part of a defendant. We believe that before the court today about res ipsa, there are only really two questions. Question number one is hypoxia the type of condition that ordinary laymen can understand and see does not occur in a modern hospital setting such as Methodist Hospitals of Dallas in the absence of negligence? And question number two, if the answer to question number one is no, which is what the trial court held, can the family use experts to establish that in fact that is a medical truth, that you cannot come out of day surgery with hypoxic brain damage if you've got adequate monitoring medically? The first question, we don't believe that the trial court answered it correctly. We've cited this court to a Washington Supreme Court decision found on page 3 and 4 of our supplemental brief, where almost the identical thing happened to a patient. In the recovery room, the patient was discovered to be having seizures, and later all brain scans, just as in this case, indicated it was hypoxic coma. And the Supreme Court of Washington held that even without any expert testimony, that not to awaken from a general anesthesia for almost a month and then with apparent brain damage is so extraordinary an occurrence within the general observations of mankind as to raise an inference of negligence. And in that Pedersen or Peterson case, they applied that doctrine to the facts before them and remanded the case for a trial using the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur. However, the trial court went further and committed an error that we believe subjects it to mandamus in this case when it held that in addition to holding that hypoxia was too complex for laymen to understand, that this family could not establish that in fact it is a res ipsa case by using medical experts. We believe that Rule 702 of the Texas Rules of Evidence disposes of this matter. It states that where scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge will assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence or to determine a fact in issue, a witness qualified as an expert may testify thereto in the form of an opinion or otherwise. We believe that the action of the trial court undertakes to restrict the use of the truth in this case. And because that is the case, a denial of due process and equal protection has been visited upon the family, such that this court can, and we believe should, interject itself in the form of a writ of mandamus remedy and require the trial court to comply with Rule 702 in this case.
Have you got any cases for the authority of the proposition that the trial court prevents you from bringing out the truth, or if the trial court denies you your rights of due process, that it ought to be corrected by mandamus rather than on appeal?
We have some cited in our brief dealing with those instances where the trial court has violated constitutional rights of due process, so forth. Off the top of my head, I don't have the cases to give you the cites, but it's cited in our brief under the section about why this is correctable by mandamus. With the passage of the rules of evidence, these rules became tantamount to a statute or the rules of civil procedure, and this court has held many times that in those instances where a trial court deviates from the clear mandate of a rule and substantial rights are affected, such as we claim the right to use the truth in this case, or to prove that which our experts say is the truth for some artificial legal reason, i.e. that we must use experts to do it, that is a denial of the kind of constitutional protections that mandamus is the remedy that's available, or it would be available for that purpose. The question might be asked, how in the world did the trial court ever come to this place? In the trial court, the defendant cited section 7.01 of 4590I and claimed that that section placed a legislative cap, if you will, on any use beyond 1977 or any expanded use beyond 1977 of the common law doctrine of res ipsa loquitur. And that since the defendant said that there were no cases directly on point where res ipsa loquitur had been established by the use of expert testimony prior to 1977, that this family couldn't establish res ipsa by using experts because of section 701 of the 4590I statute. Now, in this court, they've abandoned that particular claim. And they say, oh no, we didn't rely on section 701. The trial court, we simply argued in the trial court, and we rely upon the theory that it's always been true at common law that medical tortfeasors were just simply exempt from res ipsa loquitur if expert testimony had to be employed. So section 701 is not involved, and it didn't take away any of this family's rights because those rights never existed at common law. The family claims in this case that the Martin case cited on page 2 of our supplemental brief is controlling. In that case, the patient was burned by the use of an x-ray machine, and the experts testified that that type of burn was practically impossible if the machine is properly used. And the Court of Civil Appeals then, cited that expert testimony and used the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur expressly to affirm a judgment in favor of the patient on that basis. And therefore, to the extent that section 701 of the 4590I statute would require us to show a case where expert testimony had established res ipsa in a medical malpractice case, we say that case clearly does that. The other cases cited in our brief, the Mills case on page 3 and the Irick case on page 4, are pre-77 Court of Appeals cases where the plaintiff showed up without expert testimony and tried to establish res ipsa and failed. And on appeal, the Court of Appeals held that had the plaintiff produced the type of expert testimony it would have taken to establish res ipsa, that they could have gone forward with that doctrine, but they simply didn't have, in one case, any expert testimony, and in another case, the type of testimony that would establish the res ipsa predicate facts. We claim that the ruling of the trial court below is one that, if it's adhered to, would violate not only the rules of evidence, but would violate the rules of logic. If we're trying to get at the truth in this case, it doesn't make any sense to us why the use of experts should be denied merely because they're going to be used for a circumstantial proof case as opposed to a direct proof case. And that because of the error of the trial court in granting this defendant, if you will, either a statutory or a common law exemption from the use of res ipsa loquitur, that's the type of denial, a fair trial in this case, that the family can and does seek the remedy of mandamus for. Now, going on to the error number three, the first error being factual determination about hypoxia, the second error being the denial of the use of experts, the third error we believe the trial court made is regarding missing records. I call this section of my argument, if you can't trust your doctor with your records, who can you trust? In the trial court, we filed a pleading that claimed that the loss of material parts of the chart is the kind of spoliation that should, and we believe under Texas law does, shift the burden of proof to the defendant. The cases refer to it as the creation of a presumption of fraud or fraudulent intent on the part of the spoliator.
Captain, did you argue this at the trial court?
Excuse me?
Did you argue this at the trial court?
Yes, sir. This was part of the pleading that was stricken in the same order that struck res ipsa.
Wasn't there some reference in the brief that this is, you're alleging this for the first time here?
There is an allegation to that effect. That's incorrect. What we did was, after the trial court denied us the use of this spoliation presumption, faced with whether or not we were going to get a mandamus or not, we had to prepare for trial anyway, so we fell back, regrouped, and said, well, look, there are a number of other things that this is besides mere spoliation. It's breach of fiduciary duty. It's theft of the property of the patient. It's a number of matters. It's negligence. It's also a violation, we believe, of numerous sections of the penal code if it was done intentionally. So to the extent we've expanded the fight about these records, they're right. But to the extent that this particular pleading that we're here complaining about today was stricken, they're completely wrong in asserting that. Now, we claim that there's two types of spoliation in Texas, and that either one of them should have been applied and can be applied to this hospital. The first type of spoliation is that which takes place between strangers, people acting at arm's length. And the second, we claim, is that which takes place at the hands of the fiduciary relationship, as we would argue in this case, between the physician and his patient, or the hospital and his patient. Now, we found a case in Florida, cited in our brief on page 5 of our supplemental brief, the Valkin case. In that case, almost the identical same thing happened. A surgery took place, and a year or two later, the patient suffered an injury that shouldn't have been suffered if the surgery were done properly. And when she went back to sue the hospital for malpractice, the entire procedure, the record of the entire prior operation was just gone. In that case, no explanation, just as in this one, no explanation was offered by the patient or by the health care provider about how and where and exactly under what circumstances the record became lost. Florida court did an admirable job of citing all the different spoliation theories that states around the country use, and although they don't directly state that they did so based upon a fiduciary relationship test, the test that they used is the one that's classic to fiduciary transactions, fairness. And that court said that they deemed it the fair thing to do to impose preliminarily and prior to any trial on the merits the burden on the health care provider to establish that the spoliation or the loss was one that was not intentional on its part. And if they fail to carry that burden of proof, that an irrebuttable presumption of negligence would prevent them from defending the case. If they carried the burden of proof to establish that it was not an intentional spoliation, but merely that their negligence had led to the loss of a critical record, that thereafter the burden of proof to disprove its negligence would be upon the health care provider by reason of its negligent, if you will, spoliation of the records.
Counsel, didn't that Florida case hold that the presumption was rebuttable rather than irrebuttable? I'm asking now, I'm not really sure.
There are two presumptions. The first is whether it was intentional or not. If they carry the first predicate fact issue and they get a we do find that it was not intentional, then they go on to the negligence issue and there is a presumption of negligence which the defendant can rebut. But if they don't carry that predicate fact,
then there is no
rebuttable, it's an irrebuttable presumption. Yes, sir. Now, if you look at the cases in Texas, we find two types. There's the stranger spoliation cases, and then there is those cases that deal with breach of fiduciary duty. We find in the spoliation cases, the HEB Grocery Company case out of the Waco Court of Appeals, there an onion stalk caused a customer to slip and fall, and the onion was retrieved and discarded. And the Waco court said that that was conduct that became evidence itself and created a presumption at law that the spoliation of the onion was done with the intent to defraud the plaintiff of the use of that evidence in her case, and that that presumption had not been rebutted by the defendant, and for that reason they found the facts sufficient to, in that case, I believe it was a venue case, establish venue in the particular county of suit. The earlier case of Massey, cited on page 8 of our supplemental brief, was the spoliation of a deed. In that case, a person claimed under a deed that had been apparently intentionally spoliated by a predecessor in their title. And the trial court held and the Court of Appeals affirmed the holding that until the presumption of fraudulent intent was rebutted by the spoliator or those that stood in privity with him, that there was simply no proper predicate for the introduction of any secondary evidence whatsoever by the spoliator. Now, over and above the rules of spoliation by strangers, we say it's a different character and a different bird altogether when you experience spoliation by your doctor.
Well, how do you know it was your doctor? Why couldn't it have been anyone who had access to the records?
We don't know that it was our doctor. We don't know that it was a nurse. We don't know that it was anybody associated with the hospital, because the hospital doesn't, they swear they don't know a thing about it, and our patient was brain damaged and in a coma. Yeah, so to answer your question, we don't know it was by our doctor.
You have enough to get to the jury on in your case under the circumstances you're facing?
We have enough to establish recipsa in our case.
Well, he has been knocked out.
But if the trial judge does, as many malpractice cases go, if the trial judge strictly adheres to some of the medical malpractice cases that say that in order to establish a factual issue, you must specifically state where and when the deviation took place from the standard of care, then I don't know the answer to that question. I think there is some chance that this family might, despite its best efforts to establish the circumstances around which this injury occurred, there is some chance, perhaps a good chance, that an instructed verdict could be granted in this case.
Well, anyone listening to you is bound to know what an appealing argument that you're making in terms of trial court being wrong, and I'm not prejudging it by making that statement. I'm just sitting here listening. Now, can you get over the hurdle of why we should, if we thought that, if we thought this was wrong and racism should be used and that there should be some presumption, do you really think that we ought to do it by mandamus? I'm sitting here sort of thinking I feel like a trial judge. I don't know that I'm bothered by what kind of legal rule are we going to write?
I understand.
We did it in Jampo on the grounds that if you don't do this now, great injustice will be done. They'll never be able to get their case ready. Are you invoking Jampo? What legal hook
exactly.
do we have?
We're invoking that line of cases that says where the rights appear to be so substantial and the fair trial may very well be denied. And we are here to tell you, and I'm here to tell you, that I think, with all I know about this case, that a fair trial under the rulings of this respondent judge may very well, or probably very well, be denied our clients, even though the injury is egregious and clear, and even though the facts we believe are the truth to prove the facts is in our briefcase, we won't be allowed as lawyers for the family to use it. And
in that example, I didn't hear an answer to Judge Hill's question.
Well,
how is the harm irreparable? Why can't you assert that on the field? That's what he's asking.
I think it falls within the line of cases where this court has held, JFO being one of them, that where the remedy of appeal is not equally as efficient and beneficial as the remedy of mandamus, and the rights affected are constitutionally guaranteed, that it's more than a mere... It doesn't lie in the mouth of the defendant to argue that when constitutional rights are clearly denied and fair trial is clearly denied, that they can take this up on appeal. We believe that the very foundation of the rules of evidence has been violated by the trial court's ruling, and likewise that if a presumption of fraud exists in Texas law and the trial judge refuses to apply it and places an impossible burden on this brain-damaged patient to make him and his family prove how and where and exactly whose hands caused the loss of this record, that's exactly the type of rare and yet establishable constitutional deprivation that will allow this court to mandamus the judge. That's our position.
That's the hurdle we've got to face.
The fiduciary obligation, we believe, is much more critical to this case than the defendant would have you believe. In this case, we've got a fiduciary hospital that's failed to deliver up the chart, which we claim is the property of the patient. They failed to make any explanation thus far as to how the patient became hypoxic or under what circumstances. And they failed to make any factual accounting whatsoever about how the evidence needed to establish the specifics of this injury came to be lost under circumstances that the federal statutes governing Medicare and Medicaid patients, such as Mr. Thomas, mandate they've got to keep these records. I've made an example changing the fiduciary from a medical fiduciary to a legal fiduciary. If a client brings me a deed and asks me to record it to Blackacre, and I get busy and put it in the file and forget to, and a couple of years later, that client's family comes in and says, well, Daddy's died, and we need the deed, and we need to find out if it's been recorded because there's been a subsequent deed that showed up on the records, and the good faith purchaser may have cut us off. When I learn of that dilemma, and I go to my file, and I take the original and only copy of that deed, and I spoliate it, and I lose it, is my spoliation merely a loss of records? Or is it not also conduct that on its very face violates my fiduciary duty of loyalty and duty to my client to act in good faith and to fully account for all the evidence? Therefore, we believe the question before this court about missing records is this. Should this fiduciary hospital be granted exemption from the rules of spoliation and fiduciary duty that have existed in our state from its very inception, merely because the property lost, the record, is of a type that has no real monetary as opposed to evidentiary value? We believe clearly the answer to that question is no. And this court should so hold. Now, with reference to this, we look at the very statute the defendant used to shield itself from res ipsa, Article 4590I. Section 4.01D of that section states that all parties shall be entitled to obtain complete and unaltered copies of the claimant's medical records. We believe that this section of the malpractice statute, if you will, is statutory confirmation that in our state, our law presupposes complete factual disclosure from medical fiduciaries, hospitals, and doctors to their patients in the form of the delivery of the chart.
All right, we'll hear from the respondent.
Thank you.
May it please the court, respondent will be represented by Joanne Wilkins.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Joanne Wilkins, and I'm an associate with the law firm of Burford and Ryder in Dallas, and I represent the real party in interest, Methodist Hospitals of Dallas, who is a defendant below. Mr. Chief Justice, you have hit on the central issue in this case, and that's whether this is a proper case for the extraordinary remedy of writ of mandamus. The relators are asking this court to review rulings on special exceptions. For decades, this court has held that it is without jurisdiction to supervise and control incidental rulings in a trial court where there is an adequate remedy by appeal. This court has held that because it recognizes that if it enters this thicket, the appellate courts are going to be besieged with requests that this or that ruling of the trial court be changed and the trial process will be totally destroyed. Rulings on special exceptions can be adequately addressed on appeal as shown by the myriad number of cases where they are addressed on appeal and a decision made. Any delay or added cost in appeal has been held not to make the appellate review inadequate. The results of this court granting a writ of mandamus on special exceptions will be that regardless of whether an order grants relief or denies relief, and not just on special exceptions, plaintiffs and defendants will be petitioning the appellate court for review by writ of mandamus because this court will have recognized and acknowledged its jurisdiction over such matters and will have implicitly inferred that appellate review is inadequate. However, the results of not granting a writ of mandamus in this action are nothing, because the plaintiff is not going to be denied anything. He will still have an adequate remedy by appeal. Further, this court will not have opened the door for review by mandamus of the matters that were never intended for or included in such review. Putting aside that a writ of mandamus should not be granted because of the procedural stance of this case, the writ shouldn't be granted because Judge Whittington, the respondent, he correctly granted the special exceptions that were leveled to plaintiff's third amended original petition. In ruling on special exceptions, the trial judge looks at the pleadings, the allegations therein, and tests them against the law. In this case, the plaintiff alleged that Mr. Thomas had surgery with mask anesthesia, after which his mental and physical state deteriorated, and then that the deceased suffered a hypoxic event causing delirium and seizures. The defendant accepted to these pleadings on the basis that res ipsa was, this was not the type of case to which the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur applied. The law in this state is that res ipsa loquitur does not apply in medical malpractice cases except in very limited circumstances, such as where negligence is alleged in the use of a mechanical instrument or operating on the wrong part of the body or leaving surgical instruments or sponges inside.
In the law on res ipsa stated in Article 4590, I mean, isn't that a specific section in the 1977 Medical Malpractice Act?
Article 4590 Section 701 states that the limitation of application of res ipsa loquitur to medical malpractice cases shall be as it was at the time that the Act was adopted, which these limitations are with what were in existence at that time. This limitation on res ipsa in medical malpractice cases is consistent with the limitation in negligence cases in general, in other words, those where the type of injury or the type of accident is such that it would not ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence.
Did this involve the normal use of a mask anesthesia application?
It involved a mask procedure whereby certain anesthetics were delivered to him along with oxygen through this mask.
Well, I'm assuming that that caused the brain damage.
That is not what they have alleged, however.
Well, that is an instrument. Even under the narrow application of res ipsa in medical malpractice cases, you don't believe that the use of a mask to administer anesthetic, if it's not done properly, fits within that?
Yes, that is the use of an instrument, and if it was improperly used, then I assume that, then I would say that it does fit within the allegation of use of mechanical instruments. This is not an anesthetic case anymore because the anesthesiologist has been dismissed from this suit. The allegation
that was alleged to have caused the brain damage was the manner and way in which the anesthetic was given.
Plaintiffs allege that Mr. Thomas suffered a hypoxic condition as a result of not receiving sufficient oxygen. They do not.
Was the claim against the anesthesiologist settled or severed or what?
The claim against the anesthesiologist was settled and he has been dismissed from the lawsuit by the filing of the Fourth Amendment petition and plaintiff's cause of action. In this particular instance, you have to look at the Third Amendment petition because that is what the trial court looked at. And those allegations are that he received anesthesia, he suffered a hypoxic event. That fact, however, is hotly disputed, but the evidence is not what this court needs to be concerned with. But the allegations in this case that Judge Whittington looked at are not the type that have ever been recognized and res ipsa applied. What they have alleged is not something that is within the common knowledge of laymen, and therefore medical expert testimony will have to be produced on the standard of care and deviation from that standard. The allegations don't fall within the recognized exceptions, and therefore the trial judge, in ruling on this special exception and applying the law of this state to those allegations, did not abuse his discretion or err when he struck that pleading. Plaintiff's argument, as I understand it, is that a medical expert can establish the element of res ipsa loquitur regarding the type of accident. In other words, that this particular result is one that is within the common knowledge of in the practice of medicine that does not occur absent negligence.
What do you think happened to the records?
What I think happened to the record is that they got handled and looked at by so many different individuals being pulled in and out that it may have just slipped out, fallen to the floor, got swept up, thrown away. There's a number of scenarios that can be painted for what happened to this piece of paper.
I'm surprised you haven't argued that the plaintiff in this brain damaged state stuck in. Now surely you can give us an explanation of what happened to the records.
No one knows, Your Honor.
Who are these individuals that you say were examined?
Dr. Breen, who was called in on the day that he was.
Were they hospital personnel?
Yes, and also it was one of plaintiff's consulting physicians that they called in from outside the hospital, came in, pulled Mr. Thomas's record, spent quite a time looking at it. He testified in his deposition that the anesthesia record was in there and that he reviewed it in detail, that he did not see anything in it that caused him alarm or that could have caused what plaintiffs are claiming happened. They've had the benefit of seeing the anesthesia record. Dr. Levenstone was called in on June the 10th, some 6 days before Mr. Thomas died. The records were discovered missing. It's not real clear when his records were forwarded to the medical examiner's office. They did remark that there was something missing, so somewhere within 6 days or so, it came up missing. But no one...
We know they were there 6 days before the patient died.
Yes, because Dr. Lester...
We know they weren't there shortly after his death.
Yes.
So we've got approximately a week to explain how they got lost. Is that correct?
Yes. But to explain how something gets lost is another question.
Did you say that plaintiff's expert witness had an opportunity to view the anesthesiology report?
Yes.
Well, would you weigh objection then to any hearsay aspect if the expert just testified what he saw on there?
His deposition he cannot recall that the blood pressure at a certain time was a certain amount. He testified, though, that he reviewed them and that he recalls that nothing in them was out of the ordinary or alarming to him. I think that is all you could probably ever ask that man to do. It would be all you could ask the other doctors who reviewed them to review, because people would not recall details such as that.
Is the anesthesiologist of this deposition a part of this record?
No, Your Honor, it's not. The only thing that this
is
court...
Is the amount of the settlement with the anesthesiologist a part of the record?
No, it is only a statement contained in the plaintiff's amended petition for writ of mandamus.
What is the amount? What is the amount stated in there?
He does not state. He just states that they have settled with Dr. Miller, the anesthesiologist, and dismissed him from the suit. To go back to Ray Sipsa for just a moment, I submit to you that if a case is so complex that it needs medical expert testimony to explain what's happened and what is going on, then that is not the type of case where res ipsa should be applicable, considering what res ipsa loquitur means. The trial court considered the allegations, considered the law of this state, which states that res ipsa loquitur is not applicable in medical malpractice cases except in certain limited circumstances, and ruled accordingly. How can he err when he correctly applies the law to the facts of those cases? Okay.
Is there any summary judgment evidence as to any other possible causes of death other than what the plaintiff alleges?
This is a ruling on special exception, and there hasn't been any evidence presented to the trial court for him to look at. To go outside the record, yes, I can tell you that, but...
I don't want you to do that.
All right. In ruling on the missing records, the respondent looked at the plaintiff's third amended original petition, and that's what he ruled on. What that pleading is not what Texas law is. It is lifted wholesale from a Florida case, a case which other Florida courts have never even cited. The law in Texas is clear, and it is the same in other jurisdictions, but there must be proof of the intentional destruction of evidence by the party that is in control of it. And upon proof, then a presumption arises that that evidence is adverse to the party that destroyed it. That's not what they pleaded, and they cannot, and they did not, give any support to their pleading in the Texas law. Case law makes it quite clear that the relators have to offer some proof of the intentional destruction. Once again, how can a trial judge who looks at a pleading and then looks at the law of this state and correctly applies that law to those pleadings be said to have abused his discretion or erred? There hasn't been any abuse of discretion in this case, at least as that term has been defined by this court. The decisions are not contrary to the law. In fact, they reflect the law as it exists right now. they're not arbitrary, unreasonable rulings, and this court should not grant a writ of mandamus on special exceptions, especially when they're not wrong, and especially when it's going to open the door to this court and the other appellate courts being besieged with requests for rulings on incidental matters.
Still has a little trouble on the res ipsa point. And I'm not talking about whether this is proper mandamus. We obviously don't have to grab from that. But in his petition, he just alleges the regular garden variety. I don't see anything in it that anyone that knows anything about res ipsa doesn't see every time. So he says that mechanical devices used to perform the medical care were under the exclusive management care and control of the defendant in the hospital. What else are you supposed to allege?
You have to
invoke it.
There has to be a type of accident.
What he said in the first part, it was an occurrence or outcome which common knowledge of layman medical experts did not happen in the absence of negligence and carelessness on the part of doctors, hospital staff, and attendants. That seems very true.